Chapter 39. No Truce. Colesco Estate, Kernford. After the last 6 days, the trip back to Keelan seemed leisurely, once the clansmen confirmed the Narthani had quit the pursuit. Scouts reported that the main Narthani force had headed back to Preti, leaving a few cavalry to follow the islanders' withdrawal. The scouts also reported that 5 miles back west, a Narthani naval squadron reboarded 1,000 or more troops amid a flurry of activity as 2 frigates prepared to pull a beached transport back to sea. Traveling the 100 miles back to Kernford took 6 days, 2 days to reach Dornfeld on the Keelan-Willimer border, taking it easy on the horses and encamping in a defensible position just within Iwal territory. A day to rest at Dornfeld, then 3 days at a moderate pace back to Kernford. Josef rode most of the way on Mr. Ed. The moderate pace let him take his mind off events by concentrating in his horsemanship. Mr. Ed was younger than Seabiscuit, but had a similar sedate manner. By the 4th day, Josef forgot to concentrate on staying on his horse, as it became more natural. He felt a strange unease develop as he got nearer Kernford. By home, he still thought of their house in Abersford. The new house in Kernford was now scarred by associations with the night of the attack. He thought of the hole in Aeneas's nightshirt, a few inches difference, and he tried to shut out the memory. Anid was dead. Norlin and Miramel dead. Sinwin with the horrible wound to her face. Kulich losing the lower part of a leg. Josef thought of the men he had killed. Windows broken, doors smashed, holes in walls, attackers' bodies, blood everywhere. His own bloodlust. Could he ever get those images out of his mind? And himself? For the first time, he had killed other humans. He knew he should agonize over what he had done, no matter whether the men deserved their deaths. He should hope he never had to kill again. He should feel guilt. He should. Instead, he only wished he could kill them again. They arrived in Kernford in late afternoon. A gray overcast sky and an intermittent drizzle too closely matched Josef's mood. He only half paid attention, as words were spoken and men peeled off the column. He later remembered saying something to Dennis about the next day, then rode alone the few miles to the house. Josef hesitated as he passed Keelan Manor, seeing horses tied to the front rail and a one-horse carriage under a tree. He should see how Kulich was doing. Were Mera and Aeneas staying with her family? Despite images he couldn't avoid, he needed to see their house. He came to the turn off to their drive, and his throat tightened. His heart seemed to beat faster and harder, and his hands felt cold. The house stood empty, with no horses or carriages in front. No sounds came from within as he climbed the stairs onto the veranda. A gap took the place of the front door, although someone had repaired the part of the jam damaged when the shotgun blast took out the lock. He walked into the foyer. Bodies, splintered wood, and bloodstains were all gone. Sections of the flooring had been replaced, probably where bloodstains couldn't be completely removed. He wandered through the rest of the house. It was the same everywhere. Repairs in progress. He'd missed the workers, who had already left work for the day. Despite what happened, Mera started cleaning up and getting repairs done almost immediately. I suppose it was a way to take her mind off what happened. The thought of Mera's sister brought regret that he hadn't been here for Mera. The regret mingled with sadness at Anit's death. Renewed cold anger at the Narthani, an emerging sense of urgency to do something permanent to cleanse Cadellium of the invaders, and a sudden yearning to see and hold his wife. He walked Mr. Ed back to Keelan Manor, conflicted by the need for Mera and reluctance to once again be Joseph Kolsko. Someone must have seen him pass by the first time, for when he came to the Manor Drive, Mera was sitting on the veranda, holding Aeneas. His pace quickened enough for Mr. Ed to shy to one side, not knowing whether Joseph wanted him to move into a trot. Mera descended the stairs. He dropped the reins and they embraced, his arms around her, one of her arms around him, the other arm holding Aeneas between them. They wandered away from the house and sat on a bench within a grove of trees. Mera told him about Onnit's funeral, how hard it had been, how Kulloch broke down and wept from the bed he'd been carried on into St. Thomas Cathedral for the service, how Sinwin cried, mewing through the bandage on her face, how the cathedral had been packed and overflowed outside, how no one had anticipated the way Onnit had so much been another symbol of the Keelan family, and how the firestorm of anger against the Narthani burned fiercely throughout the clan. When Joseph asked Mera how she was doing, she cried in his arms, sobbing so hard, he wondered if this was the first time she'd let herself go totally into her grief. She subsided when Aeneas made his desire to feed known by nuzzling a breast through her dress. She wiped her eyes with her sleeve, slid a shoulder free of the dress, and guided Aeneas to her nipple. He latched on quickly.
Life goes on, Joseph. Onnit is gone, yes. Aeneas is still here. I sometimes envy the little deer for not knowing what happens around him. Even during the attack, I can only remember him looking around as if wondering what all the commotion was about.
Mera glanced down at Aeneas, then back to her husband, her face sad more than grief-stricken.
Joseph, when we have a daughter, could we name her Onnit?
Of course.
It's a beautiful name, and I'm sure her namesake would have been pleased.
The first star shone when they walked back to the manor. For the first time, Joseph noticed guards, whom his distracted mind had ignored when he'd first passed. Two guards stood at the entrance to the drive, and three at the front of the manor.
There are four more in the back, and you'll notice weapons left more in the open within the manor than before. It's a different life now than we had before, and I know I'll come to hate it. For now it's comforting, or as much as anything can bring comfort.
Merritt met them at the door and jumped to hug Joseph in a fierce, quiet embrace.
The meal is waiting, Merritt said. We didn't want to disturb you.
The manor dining room held a surprise. Instead of only the Keelan family, as Joseph had assumed it would be, with family members spread out at the large table, the table was crowded. The first person he noticed was Carnegan, naturally, since he was the largest object at the table. Joseph quickly surveyed the others seated. Only Cirrus, their cook, was missing. Otherwise present was everyone who had been at their house the night of the attack. All of those still living. Kulloch and Breda, Merid and Sinwin, Balwis, Wyfor and Tina Kales, Honorand holding Dwina, dead Miramel's daughter, Gwennet holding Morwena. Joseph felt relieved to see that Balwis and Wyfor had survived his rash idea to send them after Erdalyn. Assuming they had turned back, he knew he would hear details later.
Cirrus is visiting family,
said Mera, as if reading his mind.
So many people wanted to hear what happened on the raid, we decided to have everyone for the night here for evening meal. Father and Balwis wanted to talk with you after we eat. It's also a little strange, but we all seem drawn to one another more than before. Maybe it was the shared experience. horror of that evening. I don't know. Yosef sat with Mera on his right, Kolich on his left. He glimpsed the headman's bandaged stump. Kolich appeared pale and winced every time he shifted his body. The first question from Carnegie was about the raid, but Kolich deferred such questions until they finished the main meal. While he ate, Yosef stole glances at the other diners. Wyfor with his bandaged hand. Sinwin sipping broth with a crude straw. So she didn't have to work her jaw. The three babies. Breda with deeper lines. And, Yosef could have sworn, a few more gray hairs. Carnegie eyeing him back. For the next hour, their inconsequential conversation soothed until it died out toward the end of the meal. There being only so many times the recent and future weather could divert their attention. Finally, Kolich said, "All right, Yosef, give us all a summary of how the raid went." And so Yosef did, eliciting grunts of satisfaction when he recounted how Dennis's men had burned their way across southern Iwal province and over the border around the pretty city of Ponth. Then concern followed by relief about news of the withdrawal and Dennis's close call with the Narthani. A sharp look and a sigh of frustration came from Mera. As Yosef described the only part of the raid he had taken an active part in, moving a company and a battery of 12-pounders forward to provide Dennis with a support position should the Narthani press him too hard. He assumed he'd hear more about this later from Mera and Kolich. People asked questions as he talked, and as he went over the return trip, Breda and Merid helped Sinwin return to her bedroom. Anarind and Gwennet took the three children elsewhere in the manor. Kolich pulled Breda's chair closer and rested his three-quarter leg on a cushion that had lain by his chair.
"Morris, there's a bottle of Yosef's amaretto over there on the counter. Please bring it here, along with some glasses. I'm not normally for stronger alcohol, but somehow it seems appropriate." Balwis complied, and when they all held small glasses filled with the amber liquid, Kolich raised his glass. "To those missing." They all drank. "Death to the Narthani," Balwis said in a grating tone. All glasses emptied, they were slammed to the tabletop. Mera rose and filled every glass again, then sat. She looked at Yosef, something in her eyes. A connection sparked between them. Yosef raised his now refilled glass. "Despite all that's happened, we can't forget the good." He raised his glass even higher. "To life," he pronounced. After a second of silence, everyone present uttered the same pronouncement, and a subtle shift occurred in the mood of the table. Yosef set his glass down. "I've told you about Dennis's raid. What about the one in the north, and what about Erdalan?" As he said the last words, he glanced at Mera. He hadn't been here for her reaction when she learned he had roped Anarind into recounting all she remembered of Hanslow and Erdalan's residence. Mera looked back serenely. "The raid in the north didn't go as well," said Kolich, "although I think it succeeded in the objectives. Certainly the raids in both the north and the south make the Narthani know Iwal is vulnerable, and losing Erdalan has to have shaken their confidence." Yosef jolted up and looked at Balwis. "You got him?" Balwis nodded.
"I'd just as soon not try the same thing again, but yes, we got him. Me, Wyfor, and the other three men, only one of whom we lost. Wyfor had the honor, and I doubt we would have succeeded if he hadn't been along."
Kales waved off the compliment.
"We might not have succeeded if any of us hadn't been there."
Carnegie snorted.
The two of them have been in a love fest ever since they got back. If Y4 wasn't already married and Bolwus wasn't so disagreeable, I'd wonder when the wedding announcement would come. The ensuing laughter washed over the table as a stream of water rinses away dust. Perhaps not cleansing a surface, but at least revealing what had been hidden. The Northern Raid College, you said it didn't go as well. We'll need more details from Hetman Stent, but on the second day, the Narthani sallied out from Hounslow. Stent had divided his force to cover more ground and raise more villages surrounding the city. The Narthani surprised three companies north of Hounslow. The companies weren't of mixed clansmen, as with Dennis's regiment. These were Stent, Moreland, and Oro's companies. Wellman reports they were working their way free of the Narthani when the Moreland company abandoned their position in the withdrawal. Both the Stent and Oro's companies found themselves isolated, and both lost half their men before escaping. Naturally, Wellman was furious at the Moreland company commander, and will see that he is never again put in a command position. However, Wellman also thinks they were surprised by how fast the officer taking Erdalyn's place reacted. We thought the Narthani would be hesitant to act after the assassination, but whoever this new person is, he showed far too much initiative. Well, shit, Yosef thought. I hope in my wish for revenge or teaching the Narthani a lesson, whichever it was, that we didn't end up with a more competent officer taking Erdalyn's place. That would really be a pisser. College raised an eyebrow at Yosef. Stent's angry at himself for violating several of the principles in your On War. He believes his emotional desire to cause as much damage as possible led him to let his companies get too far apart, so they couldn't all support one another. I think your stature with him has gone up quite a bit, now that he saw what could happen when he didn't follow your advice. I suspect the same can be said for Dennis Vega. He sent several long reports ahead by riders. He thinks he has you to thank for On War, and his talks with you helping him get his mind around these complex ways of fighting. He told me it was almost like having you with him, giving advice. Even when he took the Pretty Slaves, he says he knew it violated several principles about staying focused on the objectives. But he also remembered that a leader has to use On War only for general principles, and that it was up to the leader to make decisions for any given circumstance. The return trip to Kernford had given Yosef ample time to think about the Narthani and his own roles. He recognized that the attack on the birthday party had changed him in ways he didn't fully understand, yet he was changed. What he was about to say, and he hoped to set in motion, was proof of a Yosef Kolsko he would not have recognized 3 years earlier. I would thank Dennis and Hetman Stent for their opinions, but we have something more important to consider. The Narthani attack on Swavebroke has been devastating for that clan. Although most of the people are still alive, they've lost their main city and all the history and cultural artifacts it contained. The Narthani killed two hetmen and almost a third hetman here in Keelan. They must want to hold the clans in place. I don't believe the Narthani are satisfied to simply maintain control of Pretty and the other two provinces. They must know the clans are getting stronger. Our counterattacks into Iwal and over the Pretty border, along with killing one of their top commanders, had to have convinced them that their time might be running out. I cannot imagine any scenario where the current situation, what my people would call the status quo, can last. We have to do something permanent about the Narthani. It's untenable to leave the situation as it is. Even if our responses inhibit the Narthani from future attacks, the clans would be under potential threat as long as the Narthani are on Cadellium.
I've also become more convinced the Narthani might want Cadellium so much, they'll send more troops. The fact that they've settled so many of their non-combatants on Cadellium indicates how serious they are. Right now we estimate there are 8,000 to 10,000 Narthani soldiers on the island. What would happen if they send another 20,000, 40,000? There's nothing we can do to stop them from landing while they have Preti Province as a safe base. However, if they didn't have the Preti infrastructure, the harbor, farms and ranches, and a supporting population, any more troops would have a much more difficult time. So much so that the Narthani might be forced to reconsider even abandon attempts to incorporate Cadellium into their empire.
That's what you're going to propose, isn't it, Yosef? Asked Mara. That the clans must eject the Narthani from Cadellium before they have a chance to land more troops.
Yosef hadn't told Mara of his thinking, but she'd known him long enough and was bright enough to fill in the blanks.
He's right, father, she told College. We have to settle with the Narthani once and for all.
No more reacting to what they do.
Khalid shifted his leg, wincing until he found a more comfortable spot in the cushion. He smiled the smile of a predator, an expression that seemed appropriate for the agony he felt.
It will be painful for the clans, Khalid said. Pain in the losses of life that will ensue. But I believe, for the first time, the clans will finally unite in a campaign against the Narthani.
He turned to Yosef. You may not have heard, but besides Hetman Skooks being killed by assassins, Hetman Swavebrook died with 400 of his men, as they slowed the Narthani enough to let the people of Shulik escape inland. His son is the new Hetman, and from semaphore messages it sounds like he'll be a fervent supporter of any effort to eliminate the Narthani. I wonder if the Narthani will ever realize what a mistake these attacks were.
Swavebrook and Skooks were two of the clans least interested in making coordinated efforts against the Narthani. Bevins is also now a believer. Although their headman survived, he and his clan are furious. Pawel was shocked by the Skooks' attack. And even Nivax, who we suspect of colluding with the Narthani, now seems less likely to resist any coordination.
I've been communicating with other hetmen, especially Oros, Stent, and Farkesh. We're calling a mandatory all-clan conclave for 1 month from now. Yosef groaned.
Another?
College cut him off.
I know, another conclave. But this time I think we'll get real results.
The formal topic will be a united and coordinated effort against the Narthani. What you need to do, Yosef, is work with Dennis and Vordig on exactly what action is feasible. This needs to be done quickly, so I can have input and then discuss it with key hetmen before the conclave.
I've already been thinking, College, said Yosef. I have to warn you that what I'll propose will be on a scale that dwarfs anything we've done or considered doing before.